welcome to the Essential Tennis Podcast. If you love tennis and want to improve your game, this podcast is for you. Whether it's technique, strategy, equipment, or the mental game, tennis professional Ian Westerman is here to make you a better player. And now, here's Ian.
Hi, and welcome to the Essential Tennis Podcast, your place for free, expert tennis instruction that can truly help you improve your game. Today's episode of the Essential Tennis Podcast is brought to you by SomersetSportsPerformance.com and also TennisTours.com. Before we get started with today's show, I want to remind you guys about the Essential Tennis Clinic that I'm going to be running at the end of August. It's going to be August 29th and 30th, a Saturday and Sunday on the north side of Baltimore. I have two spots left. Currently, I have 10 people signed up for the clinic. So if you're interested in receiving instruction from myself in person, you need to send me an email quickly at ian@essentialtennis.com if you would like to participate. Let's go ahead and get started with today's show. I have a guest on with me, and we're going to be discussing differences between different teaching techniques or styles when it comes to tennis in general, and specifically having to do with topspin. So sit back, relax, and get ready for some great tennis instruction. My guest today on the Essential Tennis Podcast is Ron Miller. Ron is a fellow tennis podcaster. For those of you who are not familiar with his podcast, it's called Gotta Play Tennis, and Ron provides tips, history, and also tennis instruction geared towards the recreational level player. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
To start off, why don't you tell us a little bit about your website, your podcast? Tell us how long you've been doing it and kind of what your goals and your aspirations are for what you're doing.
Sure. My website is gottaplaytennis.net. I was trying to be clever with the .net part. I don't know if that was a mistake or not, but
nice.
I started putting together this website, and I've been a tennis instructor going on 30 years part-time in a recreational environment. And I had this sense that I wanted to start putting something together where I could start, you know, giving back or leaving somewhat of a legacy of things that I've learned through the years in working with students. So I started investigating, putting together this website, and was really interested in podcasting. I came across your podcast on iTunes, and you and I had some conversations back and forth on email, and came up with the Gotta Play Tennis podcast. And it's been really fun, and I've been learning along the way.
Yeah, and I've really enjoyed watching you develop your idea, your website, and I've listened to all the shows that you've done. And Ron is also on iTunes. You guys can find him by searching for Tennis Podcast or Gotta Play Tennis is probably the quickest way to find him on iTunes. And Ron does an excellent job with his production. His recording and production value is extremely high. And Ron does things a little bit differently than my show. It's a little bit shorter format. Ron, you know what? I'll let you explain it. Tell us a little bit about the format of your show and exactly what you try to do each week.
Well, I want to give some different types of topics available. Some things are more how-to in terms of, you know, giving some specific technique tips to both, you know, students, so children and adults. But then sometimes I'll do some historical things as well. For instance, I've done something on the French Open when that was really big, and I intend on doing something for Wimbledon as well. Of course, we can't forget these huge Grand Slam tournaments. And my format is quite short, and I keep it probably under 10 minutes or so, and then I do a slight change on there with a historical tennis moment, things that I've experienced through the years in watching tennis and some things I've been seeing over the years that I think really kind of bring to light some of the techniques and so on. I try to tie in with the podcast.
Cool. Well, I've really enjoyed your show, and it's one of many podcasts that I subscribe to and listen on a weekly basis. So I hope you keep it up. You're doing a great job, and I've enjoyed it a great deal. Everybody who's listening to my show, I really suggest that you go check it out. It's a good supplement and good addition. It's a good contrast to what I'm doing here on the Essential Tennis Podcast. Ron, I like how you've set it up because you've got a nice niche. It's a very different type of show than mine is, and it's very enjoyable. So I hope you keep it up for a while to come.
Yeah, and I want to, you know, give props to you, Ian, because you've been very, you know, helpful in getting me started on this. I did have a lot of technical questions and otherwise about how to get this started, and I really appreciate the fact you've gotten me up and running and helping me with this. And I think you're right. I think we fill a slightly different area, and I think it's a great value for the two together. And I also listen to yours on a regular basis as well.
You bet. Yeah, I was happy to help you out, and. You and I are very similar in our approach to the game. We're both lifelong students of the game, and we both really enjoy instructing and teaching people, and yet we have very different backgrounds. We come from different eras in tennis, and that's why I wanted to have Ron on the show today. He and I are going to have a discussion back and forth about two main topics, and they're kind of historical is the wrong word, but that there are topics that are viewed differently depending on when you grew up in tennis and kind of your preconceived notions on how tennis should be played. And we're going to explain further. But basically, you know, let's face it, I'm not very old yet. I'm only 28 years old. I just graduated from college 5 years ago. And so I grew up learning tennis right around the time where topspin really started to become in vogue and popular, and everybody on tour was starting to use a lot of it. Not that it hadn't been used for, you know, a while before then. We all know that Borg and other players hit with topspin, but clearly the game has gotten stronger and faster and more aggressive over the last 20 years or so. And so I kind of grew up where that was what I was taught, was how to hit with topspin immediately and be aggressive and learn how to have weapons. Ron, rather than put words in your mouth, I want you to describe when you grew up in tennis, when you started playing, and how the era where you grew up playing and learning was different from when I grew up playing and learning. And my hope is here, guys, those of you who are listening, is that you'll be able to kind of pick and choose which side maybe you align most closely with. I know that my listeners span a very wide range of ages and backgrounds, and I think this is going to be a really interesting discussion back and forth between Ron and myself about, you know, which how tennis has evolved, where it's come from, where it's going, and Ron and I have very different viewpoints about some things, and yet I think you guys will find that we're very similar when it all comes down to it. Ron, why don't you tell us a little bit about when you grew up playing tennis and the differences that you think there are between then and today, the current game.
Sure. When I was growing up watching tennis, again, topspin wasn't as big as it is today, although, you know, I definitely grew up through the Borg era as well. And, you know, that was really so unique and different at the time. And I remember distinctly, you know, watching and growing up with watching the flat and drives on the forehand and backhand side, with Jimmy Connors, and maybe had even John Newcomb. And I mean, I could go back and talk about some of the older players. But the point being that the game has evolved so much since then. And I think, you know, partly because of the evolution of the rackets, power has become such a huge part of the game. And to enable to control that power, I think topspin became something that more and more people used to control the ball and still be able to hit it and keep it within the court boundaries. So definitely growing up in a different era, and I probably, like most people, if you stay in tennis long enough, you start to emulate these pros and you start to try all kind of different things because you say, hey, wait a minute, if they're having such a good time with it and they're doing so well, maybe I should just hit like that person. Right. And of course, so I had my Connors era, I had my Borg era, I had my McEnroe era. I had different eras that I tried to emulate. And of course, what you do is you sort of absorb all those different things into your game and you eventually become who you are today.
Good stuff. Well, because Ron and I grew up watching different eras in tennis, we have a little bit different take when it comes to instruction as well. And this is where our conversation is going to come in on technique. And Ron and I have been emailing back and forth for quite some time. And oftentimes Ron sends me an email to kind of give me his thoughts on a recent show that I've done. And he sent me an email, I think it was earlier this week or maybe late last week about a question I answered recently having to do with hitting a slice on a low ball as opposed to topspin. And I had said, I had made a statement that whenever possible, I want my students to be hitting a topspin or a drive type shot and use slice only when it's really an emergency. And Ron, why don't you tell my listeners what your opinion is on that statement?
Well, it was interesting because, you know, I've always felt, and again, not that I don't use topspin in my game, I certainly do, but I don't use what I would consider to be radical topspin. You know, today the players are using the semi-Western or Western grips, and of course they're hitting a lot of these balls at a much higher level, and I say higher, not necessarily at a stronger level. Of course, they are doing that as well. But when I say higher level, the ball's bouncing a lot higher, and the ability to hit those high balls using topspin is something that is definitely beneficial, especially on the forehand side. But the backhand drive or the forehand drive, to me, were the mainstays of tennis. And certainly using slice was something that was I always found to be extremely beneficial, and not necessarily only in a defensive way, but also in an offensive way, because we tend to, and I think this is in where you and I kind of started to see things slightly differently. you were, to you, being aggressive meant hitting a topspin shot. I'm assuming deep into the court, because that one of the fears of topspin is that you hit with too much topspin, the ball drops short in the court. And Borg was a master of this. Although he was hitting the ball short in the tennis court, there's such a big hop that brought the ball back, he was still very effective with it. But he could really whip at that ball and still keep the ball in play. And of course, we see that with the Nadal and so on of today. But for me, again, I always saw that the slice being the kind of shot where I could be late on the ball, not necessarily be as well prepared, but still pull off a very, very offensive shot, certainly on an approach shot. And I just didn't see equating a slice shot with being defensive. To me, topspin could be defensive as well, as in, say, the topspin lob, or just hitting a topspin shot when you're way out of position, which I've done many times, but also hitting the slice shot when you're way out of position. And you see the pros using all of these tools that they have available to them. And I see many, many times, I see personally when I watch the game, that they'll hit in a very, very offensive slice shot. Certainly, usually on the backhand side more so than on the forehand side. But keep in mind, again, I'm looking at the players that I'm seeing on the tennis court on a recreational level, and I think probably both in kids and adults. And because of that, I see the slices being one of the what I would call the bread and butter shot, as opposed to the topspin, which I would consider to be, in my mind, more of an advanced level shot for the kind of people and kids that I deal with.
So, would you listen, audience, this is why I wanted to have Ron on. I've had people tell me before, Ian, your guests are great. I enjoy listening to your show, but you and your guests just always agree on everything. So it's not very interesting conversation back and forth. And here's an area where Ron and I, we come from different backgrounds. We teach different kinds of people in different settings. And so we have different viewpoints on this topic and one other one that we're going to get to. But Ron, let's kind of go back and forth on this topspin versus slice, aggressiveness versus defensiveness. And this is a very interesting topic for me, and I think for my listeners as well. And would it surprise you to learn that really the first thing that I teach a beginner, I'm talking to somebody who hasn't had a lesson before, would be an upward swing path towards the ball, i.e. a topspin swing on both forehand and backhand?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me temper that with saying that when I start teaching children and I teach them a shot, it's not slice that I'm teaching them first. So let me back up a little bit. That is not the first backhand that I'm teaching them.
Okay.
I'm basically teaching them more of a backhand drive. The contact of the ball is the contact of the ball, and whether or not you drive it a little more forward or with a little more of an upward motion will determine, you know, how much or how little topspin that you have. But as they're striking the ball, there's a slight opening of the racket face as they continue progressing up towards the sky with their shot on the backhand side. That is a little more of a backhand drive that I'm teaching them. And to me, the idea of going straight forward through a ball but going low to high is going to give them perhaps light topspin, but certainly not what I would consider to be aggressive topspin or really promoting the idea of it being a sharp upward action on the ball. So I just wanted to temper that and say that even though I promote slice very much, I don't necessarily say that that would be the first shot I would teach you. I would teach more of a flat drive first. That would probably finish with a slightly more open racket face just to clear the net, again, going low to high. Then I would try to get some kind of a sharp action going more vertically.
Okay. Well, let me temper what I'm about to say then by saying that I think slice is very valuable. It's a shot that this is interesting because we're very opposite on this. It's a shot that, in my opinion, I would teach somebody as they become more advanced, as they become stronger and stronger, and they're able to hit the ball with more confidence and with a little bit more aggressiveness. And I use the word aggression kind of tentatively, because it's aggression and beginner tennis player are two things that shouldn't really go together. But as they get the ability to start to hit the ball more strongly, for myself, in my teaching, only as they start to demonstrate to me that they can do that consistently will I start thinking about showing them how to slice the ball at all. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is that I want my students to have as good of a shot at becoming as good of a player as possible. I develop long-term relationships with people, and where I'm teaching right now, there's people, I've been at my current club for 3 years, and there's people that I've been giving private lessons to on a weekly basis, or even more than once a week, for all 3 years that I've been there. And so I have a very long-term minded approach for everybody that I work with. And basically, if they come to me wanting to become better at tennis, I'm going to teach them technique that is going to serve them best long-term, like not necessarily next week, but 5-10 years from now. And what really stuck out to me most technique-wise, for what you were talking about, Ron, is that you were talking about hitting more of a flat drive, where it's, you know, a little bit more of a horizontal swing as opposed to a vertical one, and actually finishing with the face slightly open. And I oftentimes hit that way when I'm rallying with the students, and I want to just give them consistent, easy to read shots over on their side, no spin one way or the other. However, in my teaching with a student, I'll typically make it very clear to them that on a ground stroke, I will tell them that I don't want them to have the racket face open at all during any part of the swing, ever, because I want them to immediately start building confidence that they can make a good upward swing at the ball and not worry about the ball going long, because that's a beginner's really biggest fear, in my opinion, on ground strokes, is that, oh, if I hit the ball too hard, it's going to go too far. And when people tell me that, I say, no, it has nothing to do with how hard you hit the ball. It has to do with your technique, and the racket face has to be flat and maintain the flat angle at the very least through the point of contact to allow it to make a good confidence swing and not worry about the ball going too long. So I kind of cringe when I hear you say hit and then open the face through the point of contact or after contact, because that's kind of the opposite of how I typically teach people. What's your response to that?
Well, that's kind of why we're having this conversation.
Yep.
because interestingly enough, one of the things that I always find with students, especially on the backhand side, is the fact that, I mean, it is their non-dominant side. And I think we kind of all struggle with that opposite side of our body. You know, one of the things I do with kids immediately is just to kind of prove out this theory, and sometimes I try it with adults, is I'll roll a ball to them, whether it be any kind of ball that I have with me, typically a tennis ball or something. Sometimes I have something larger. And I say, just kick the ball back to me. And I'll do this twice in a row. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, both times, if they're right-handed, they'll immediately kick it with the right foot. And they do that automatically without me asking which foot to kick it with. They do that because they're right side dominant. So therefore, everything on their right side is very, very comfortable to them.
Sure.
As soon as I ask them to do something on their left side, it's immediately going to become less comfortable. And so therefore, what I find is in students, they tend to, you know, while we're practicing a shot, they might, you know, turn their shoulders enough. But when you start to do any kind of rallying, now you have a situation where no one wants to turn their shoulders enough. And if you really want to hit a good topspin backhand, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not really sure how effective you could be with even a semi-open stance on a topspin backhand. I think, especially for a beginner, where you're trying to time that. Again, you and I had a discussion about, it's a question of ball height and distance from your body in terms of getting that timing right. And my feeling is that I know that on the slice backhand, that not only can you catch the ball later and still hit an effective shot, even with the ball slightly behind you, which is on a topspin backhand would be really tough to do. But not only that, but in addition to that, those high balls that bounce up, high to low allows you to handle a lot of those balls very, very effectively in the backcourt. And again, a topspin backhand that on a high ball, unless you're going to take it on the rise, is really kind of tough.
Yes, I agree. I have a one-handed backhand myself, and I know exactly what you're talking about. When you are out of position on a one-handed backhand, everything becomes very difficult, timing-wise, and it takes a lot more strength. When the ball gets above your strike zone, you're talking about those high bouncing shots, and I agree with that. And because of that, I use a slice a lot, personally. You know, when I go out and play a competitive match, I slice a lot on my backhand side. I slice almost never out of 500 forehands in a competitive match for myself. I might slice like three, and it would be when I'm way the heck off the court and kind of play like a squash type shot, like you'll see Roger do once in a while. But on the backhand side, I'm just not very comfortable. And that's definitely one of the times where I would tend to lean towards your side, Ron, is on the backhand side, where you're talking about somebody just not being as coordinated on that side and just not having the same confidence and use of their body, really. They just don't have the same physical facilities over on that side to be able to hit the ball as confidently and as strongly. And I will agree with you that in general, a slice is an easier ball to put in play. It's an easier shot to just make. However, and this is where I start to think more long term, you know, 2-3 years from now, yes, you can make everything being relative, yeah, you can make a slice a better shot. And we see the pros, like you said, sometimes use a slice for an aggressive shot, oftentimes when they're approaching to the net. However, given the choice between the two, if I could instruct my students to either be confident with topspin and hitting the ball aggressively that way, or hitting the ball with slice where the margin for error is lower because the ball has got to travel lower over the net, slice makes the ball travel farther, and so you can only really hit a slice so hard before it starts going out. And I have a feeling I know what you're going to say in response to that, but I want to hear you say it, so go ahead.
Well, it's in terms of the slice, I don't necessarily think of it as a power shot. But then again, I don't necessarily think an offensive shot is a power shot.
There we go. Yeah, I knew that was coming.
you knew I was going there.
Absolutely. Keep going.
Because, you know, let's talk approach shot, for instance. I mean, it's not uncommon to use a slice on the approach. And one of the main reasons for that is you keep the ball very low, forcing your opponent to hit up, which, of course, you want them to hit up. You're on top of the net.
Right.
So that you can hit down. And now you can have that great angle and put away the ball. So, you know, the slice shot is going to be something whereas, no, it's not going to be hit as hard, but it does keep the ball low to the court. It's also something whereas, again, especially in today's game, when you talk about the heavy-duty topspin, remember, and as you well know, the topspin is spinning towards you. As you slice the ball, you're not meeting the ball and changing the spin direction. You're simply blending with the spin direction. So therefore, I'm taking what someone has given me, this tremendously forward-spinning ball, and I'm blending with it and just adding to it. So in essence, in a way, it's kind of a counterpunch shot, which is really a nice thing to do. And if you can get that and slice that into it with a good angle in the court, keeping it low, and then especially if you're approaching the net, I find that to be extremely effective. And then in addition to that, if you can take that slice, and not that I'm trying to add a little extra to it, but sometimes you can slice that shot and curve it just a little bit more, and you end up adding a little bit of a side spin to it, and that can really throw your opponent off, along with hitting a little bit of a floater, which one might say, oh, great, now they're going to kill me with it. But sometimes you give them a little extra time to think, and they're used to the ball pounding back at them. And to be honest, this was very, very effective for Arthur Ashe against Jimmy Connors at Wimbledon, I seem to recall.
Yes, and what year was that?
Before your time, I think.
I went there. I'm sorry. Yeah, listen, I've watched classic tennis matches. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's just that for in my world, I guess, I mean, having played collegiate tennis, and playing USTA tennis at a 5.0 level. To rely, I mentioned earlier in the show that I very often rely heavily on a slice shot on my backhand side. I hate that. I hate that I have to slice. The only reason why I slice is because I'm not good at hitting topspin on my backhand side. It's just something I've never developed and gotten comfortable with. And as a result, that's my biggest liability by far. And Ron, you made the statement that an aggressive shot is not necessarily a hard shot or a fast shot. And I agree with that. That being said, do you feel like not having the ability to hit a faster paced shot on either your right or your left side, not having that ability at all on one side of your body, do you feel like that's at some point that's going to become a big liability for a player?
Oh, I definitely would say, and I certainly would agree that you have to have all the tools. And let's face it, you know, why would you go out there with your tool belt with only it being half full? I mean, there's no reason why you shouldn't try to develop every type of shot, which is what's excited me over the years with tennis and what's kept me going all these years. And I mean all these years. the fact that you can continually add to your repertoire of shots, and I think that you have an opportunity to always learn a new and different kind of shot. I think it's great to have an aggressive weapon. I think people they'll think twice about putting a different shot to you because they know how aggressive you can be with it, no mm-hmm. doubt. But I think also the ability to either take the pace off a shot or to keep it really low, again, with these high bouncing topspin shots, or to come in and take a ball on the rise, say, with a little bit of a chip shot and then approach the net. I think these can be very, very offensive and effective shots. I typically will use the slice, again, mostly when I'm a little bit late with the ball on the backhand side. But I will also use it offensively when I feel as though I can get a person out of position because I'm seeing where they're standing in the court. And if I have to go for pinpoint accuracy, I'm going to go with the slice backhand because I know I can place it better in the court with the slice and perhaps get it closer to a line or something, whereas I know I'm going to stretch them out. And then I could just go up and take advantage of that at the net. When I have more time to hit a ball and I feel very, very comfortable with the bounce and the distance and so on, I'll definitely go for the topspin at that point. But again, I don't necessarily feel as though that's going to be my best shot.
Okay. And by the way, I want to clarify something that I said a couple minutes ago. I asked you what year was that, Connors versus Ash, and I didn't say that in order to sound like I was disrespecting an elder by any means, but simply to preface my talk about my own play and the level of play that I've played over the years. A level in where if you don't have the ability to hit a ball strongly on one side of your body, I mean, it's very, very difficult to be successful at a strong 5.0 level or above if you don't have the ability to hit the ball hard on both sides and not necessarily just aggressive. I do agree with you, Ron, that oftentimes an aggressive shot can be sliced. It just depends on the point situation. That being said, in this day and age, you can only make it so far. For example, earlier today, I watched Roger Federer. He played against, what's the name of the 6'10 player that he just played today?
Yeah, you know, and I saw it myself as well, totally and I can't blanking. Remember his name because he's just not in the forefront.
Yeah, let me look that up because that's really, really bothering me that I can't remember it because I know who it is.
I know more about the other guys. Tommy Haas.
Ivo Karlovic is who he played. And Karlovic has a massive serve. And once the point gets started, however, he's got a good forehand. He's actually kind of like me, but I don't have a serve anywhere nearly as big as his. But he has a very, very good serve. He has a good forehand. He has a decent net game. And he has no backhand. He slices his backhand, you know, probably 90% of the time. Once the point got started, Roger, I mean, it was just not even funny. Like, it was just no contest at all. Roger had problems returning the serve and, you know, just like everybody else in the world does. But because he had no backhand, it was just a matter of time until Roger returned enough of his serves, got into enough points that Roger was going to come out on top, and he beat him in straight sets. And so I guess that's the big difference in era for me. you know, back in the day of Ash and Connors and McEnroe and Borg, you could actually use, and before that time, by the way, not just them, but you could use exclusively a slice and be one of the best players in the world. And it's just not the case anymore today. And so I guess that's my point, is that's kind of the perception that I've grown up with. And that's the reality that I played with. When I played a doubles match in college against somebody with a good serve, a good nationally ranked person in Division II, which is the division that I played college tennis in, once they found out, you know, the difference between my forehand and backhand, I was lucky to see another forehand the whole rest of the match. It would be all backhands. And my slice backhand is not a bad shot. It's pretty competitive for my level of play, but it's just not, it was not good enough against a good server and a good net player in doubles. And so what this might come down to, Ron, is just a difference in perspective. You having grown up watching the greats of that era use a slice very commonly and very, very effectively. And myself having grown up watching guys like Pete Sampras, who did use a slice effectively, by the way, Andre Agassi, those are all players that knew how to use a slice, but it's something that they would use when the point situation presented itself in such a way that it made sense. And it's a shot I use as well, and it definitely has its place. But without some kind of strong shot on that side, I feel like a player can only become so good before it becomes a big liability.
What and again, go ahead. Keeping in mind that, you know, the recreational level of players that I'm dealing with, I tend to think that that's a shot that could be very, very effective for them at their level. And I'm not expecting any of these players to, you know, be 5.0 players or go beyond. And I just think that it's something that if they could develop that in their game, it could be very, very effective for them against opponents. Again, especially if they're going against somebody who's hitting a lot of topspin, or just people who are doing, you know, basic drive shots and so on.
Sure.
I think if they can develop a nice slice backhand and a slice forehand, again, I don't want to, let's not forget the slice forehand, because you, like you said, you would hit maybe three out of I don't know how many. I don't use the slice forehand that often, but of course, we could talk about how effective a slice forehand can be down the line on an approach shot, and it can be. So, you know, we can go there.
Yeah. And yeah, that's a shot that Connors perfected as when he was in his prime. But yeah, I think, yeah, this comes down to the types of people that we teach and also the eras that we grew up in. And I think the most important thing to point out here to our listeners is that neither of us are discounting the importance of the other person's preferred shot at this point. They both have their place and they're both very important. And I like the I like how you likened your tennis game to kind of having a tool belt, Ron, and having the more tools you have to complete the job. And as somebody who has worked on cars myself, you have to have the right tool for the job. And if you don't have it, the job just becomes 100 times more difficult. And so, yeah, Ron and I both want everybody listening to become well-rounded players. You have to have use of a lot of different shots to be successful. And Ron and I are kind of discussing the merits and the drawbacks of two specific shots. And hopefully it's been informative to our listeners, because we're all out of time. And Ron and I had two topics lined up and we only talked about one. I'm not surprised at all. And Ron, I'd love to have you back sometime to talk about one-handed backhand versus two-handed backhand as it relates to teaching and technique and all those kind of things specifically, just like we've talked about today. So hopefully you can come back on the show sometime soon.
Sure, I would love that.
Ron, thank you very much for joining me, and I appreciate your time. And everybody check out Ron's podcast and his website. And again, that is gottaplaytennis.net. Is that correct, Ron?
That's correct.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much, Ron.
Thank you, Ian. And again, I appreciate all your help.
You bet. Take care. All right, that brings the Essential Tennis Podcast, episode number 73, to a close. Again, I want to thank Ron Miller for being my guest on the show today. Let me know what you guys thought of that episode. It's definitely a different topic or format than what I've done in the past. I did get some feedback on the forums from kind of my most connected listeners to myself, and they all seemed to think it was a good idea. So hopefully the rest of you thought it was enjoyable as well. I'd love to hear some feedback from you. If you have some thoughts either positive or negative about the formats and the topic, etc. I'd love to have Ron back on the show in the future if it's something that you guys are interested in. And real quickly to wrap up today's show, I would just like to send a warm birthday wish to Jocelyn in New York City, who's a new listener of the Essential Tennis Podcast. Jocelyn's birthday is on July 8th. I'm recording this on the 6th. So Jocelyn, happy birthday to you. And I know that you're working on your mental game, your mental toughness. Let me know if I can help you in any further way than the shows that we've already done on mental toughness with David Grumping on the Essential Tennis Podcast. But happy birthday on July 8th. All right, that does it for today's show. Thanks very much for joining me, everybody. Take care and good luck with your tennis.